Hey, it's Brian Murphy here, and whether you're orchestrating a corporate gathering, gearing up for a team-building session, or just seeking a spot to savor thrilling sports and activities, the Clubhouse in Fremont is the go-to destination for bistro, bar, bocce, golf, and fitness. From team-building to private golf lessons on any one of 140 golf courses around the world, the Clubhouse in Fremont has you covered. Visit FremontClubhouse.com to learn more about their amazing amenities and private events. The Clubhouse in Fremont, the Bay Area's place to play.
Hey, we're back with you on The Sports Leader. Dieter Kurtenbach hanging out until 11 p.m., and I am so excited to talk some NBA hoops with the great Dan Favalli of Bleacher Report. He joins us now on the UMA guest line. Danny, are the Celtics going to do this thing? Is this happening?
I feel like it might after you watch the last two games. Just the way that their defense has picked up and really, I think, exposed Miami's lack of on-ball decision-makers after Butler, especially with the Gabe Vincent injury in game five. The thing I keep coming back to, though, is it's really hard to beat the same team four times in a row in the playoffs. And so I want to lean towards history and say, no, they're going to lose in game six or seven. But if I don't know, just after watching and the way that they've been hitting their threes and the way that the ball is moving, they're getting into early offense and just the defense, the way Robert Williams III has played defensively, specifically the pick and roll with him and Tatum, they look by far and away right now as the better team. And so I'm so very tempted to say yes, but I'm just going to lean towards the numbers and history and say no, that they probably they'll drop one of these next two games.
I'm with you. I mean, it has looked lopsided, certainly yesterday and even the game before that. There are certainly some holes that have been exposed. I'm with you 100%. What I can't seem to get over is that the Celtics have done this all season. They have such little respect for their opponents. They play with such an entitlement for a team that has won so very much and yet nothing. I can't understand them. Maybe I totally get it and I just give them no respect at all. Or maybe I don't understand that. Like, why are the Boston Celtics like this? Why is it that they can't just come and do the job the way it needs to be done? Everything has to be dramatic and climactic and unnecessarily extra. And if you and I are right, it's going to get them burned because they just didn't show up to the damn dance.
Yeah, there's the word that I've used a lot with them over the past 2 years is there's this really big variability in their performances. And I think that happens when you're so reliant on threes as they are. They're taking over 40 per game, I think, in these last two, which is great when you're shooting over 40% on them. But when you're missing them, I feel like it spills over to the other end of the floor for them, where then they're not defending as well. It's these nights where they shoot poorly from three is where their defense also falls apart. And it feels like they sometimes struggle to get to that extra dimension. And was that in this series specifically, did they go to RW3 too late in the series and they should have done that sooner? He didn't look too great to start the series. Is it, you know, just Jaylen Brown trying to play through, I think he has an elbow injury? I don't know, but I'm with you in the sense that like the variability, the inconsistency with which they play, I've actually given up trying to explain it because it's kind of inexplicable when you see what, I mean, look at what their peak is and look at how much talent they actually have when you look at 1 through 7, 1 through 8 in their rotation. It doesn't even make sense, even when you are accounting for, all right, this is a make or miss league, and sometimes if you take a lot of threes, you're going to miss a lot of threes.
Yeah. Yeah. Is Joe Mazzulla at all to blame? It's not as if they weren't doing this under Ime, and it's not as if Ime didn't have to come in. Ime Udoka, for those who aren't on a first-name basis with the former Celtics coach. it's not as if Ime Udoka didn't have to come in to take over for Brad Stevens because Brad had lost the locker room. I mean, what do you make of the coaching scenario that they have going? Because going up against Eric Spoelstra, you're going to get your ass kicked. And it seems as if Joe Mazzulla has gotten his ass kicked pretty roundly, even with the Celtics being back in this thing.
Yeah, there's been, you know, the reluctance at the beginning of the series to go with dual bigs. And we've all seen the jokes about he's saving timeouts to take home to his family sometimes. So I get the frustration. But I also look to the Celtics of last year, and I mean, you intimately watch them when they're going up against the Warriors. There's a lot of the same stuff that's happening.
Totally.
Ime Udoka was able to transform their defense, but that inconsistency, that variability, I don't know if it's just baked into their personnel. You know, you were describing it. Is it actually something that's intangible, where it's just like they don't have the respect of their opponents, or
they're
they don't
soft.
Respect their opponents at all?
They're soft.
So
they're not just soft, they're
I'm
entitled.
Open to anything.
I mean, it legitimately, I mean, you remember when Ime got brought in? It's because they had tuned out Brad Stevens because Brad Stevens couldn't get them to be dogs. Not to have a call back here. Brad Stevens coming in and saying, you got to fight, you got to punch. Like, that's not going to play. You just look at him and you're like, you're not the messenger here. Ime Udoka's entire personality is like, I'm going to go break some rules, which then he got in trouble for. So I don't think Joe Mazzulla, who's, you know, out there with the cross on and all, and more power to him and his beliefs, like, by all accounts, a really nice dude. He was a backbench coach on last year's Celtics team, thrusting him into the number one job. It feels like they're back with Brad Stevens, and that's a fundamentally flawed team because you don't have a true alpha. Forgive me. Like, Jason Tatum's a really wonderful and eminently talented player. He does a lot of dumb stuff, and I know he's got to work through it, but it's like, when you've been in the Eastern Conference Finals as much as he's been, you'd like to think that some of the lessons would have been learned by now. Jaylen Brown goes the other way, where he disappears for long stretches of time, and then he decides, actually, you know, when things were working out, I wasn't getting enough dribbles in, so let me put this one off my foot and into the second row. You got Marcus Smart, who's not actually a point guard, can't get anyone into sets, but is a brilliant defensive player, so you don't really know what to do with them. You got Robert Williams III, who some days looks like he shouldn't be in the league, and other days is the most jaw-dropping defensive player in the league. I mean, just a brilliant, he's spectacular. He's so fun to watch when he's at his best. You just never know when that's going to show up. Al Horford didn't go to the free throw line for 3 months. Not making it up. Didn't go for the free throw line. Last time he was at the free throw line before game four, I believe, was in March. Like, this is a team that's soft and not necessarily well built. And I want to take it one step further here. Like, what does Malcolm Brogdon do on this team, Dan?
I mean, he does give you, like, that secondary ball handling and, like, the extra spacing. I do think what some of the stuff that you've laid out, one of their biggest, I guess, flaws, if they were to look at this roster, should they lose the series heading into next season, functionally, it does feel like they could use someone who is more dominant or more of a actual captain from the point of attack, to where Jaylen Brown's only improved incrementally as a passer over the past 2 years. Jason Tatum is fine, but he's going to be secondary there. And you mentioned Marcus Smart, who is, they use him as their point guard a lot of the times, where they'll deviate and go to Tatum or even Brown, but he's not that guy. And even if it's not a conventional point guard, I do think you could make an argument that this team needs a floor general. And they're very much filled with, when you look at their playmakers and table setters, a bunch of really good secondaries who aren't primaries in that role.
I mean, one of the things that I've always maintained is that you need a bucket getter and you need an operator on offense in order to win in the playoffs. And they have bucket getters, though it'd be nice if Jason Tatum ever wanted to hang out in the mid-range. Like, watch one Kevin Durant piece of tape and maybe emulate that guy, because he has the kind of size to be able to do that. And I think he can knock down shots, maybe not at a Durantian level, that's all time, but pretty close. So just, you know, go to the mid-range every now and again. Go watch Jimmy Butler. That's what he does too. He got Brown, like, they don't have an operator. Let's play the game. I'm going to put you on the spot. Who would be a guy who would fit that role? We don't have to make the salary cap work here. Like, if you could bring in one player to get the Boston Celtics over the hump in a reasonable trade or perhaps even a signing, who would it be?
That is a great question, and I don't even know that I would have, like, an actual answer to. But if they had someone like a Mike Conley on their team, I think it could be that. I don't want to say low level, but a glue guy like that.
Totally.
But I do think, when you look at their roster, they're kind of only set up to make a really big trade if they wanted to. And so if you see someone like if a Trae Young becomes available, maybe even if a Damian Lillard, just because he's at least that shot maker, even if you don't consider him a floor general.
Definitely an alpha.
If they fizzle out in the Eastern Conference Finals this year, should any of those guys become available, would they at least look at it? But I don't think – it doesn't need to be a megastar, but when you look at their salaries and the players on their roster – you're giving up someone who's super valuable and important anyway, that you almost might need to aim for a bigger swing.
I feel like Kyrie Irving would have worked really well on this team. Oh, time has passed, indeed. Let's swing it over as we talk to the great Dan Favalli of Bleacher Report. We do this all the time. Golden State Warriors, they didn't do too well, Dan, and it's hard to say that we didn't see it coming on the basis of they sucked all regular season. They barely made the real playoffs, and they were inconsistent and old and disjointed and had team chemistry issues, and it was a hot mess this season for the Golden State Warriors, and I think that that has created an appetite in the fan base for a bit of a shakeup. Let's specifically get rid of that Jordan Poole guy, and let's see what you can get for him. What are you hearing as it pertains to the possibility of moving Jordan Poole? Like, what are you hearing, and what piques your interest on that dimension?
I don't think you hear too much, a lot of which is probably just eclipsed by, okay, what's going to happen with Bob Myers first, and then they'll go from there. But this also isn't a franchise that has acted very impulsively on that front. Mm-hmm. But you are at a point now, because of the more punitive collective bargaining agreement, that the only thing you can really do is run it back with a bunch of additional minimum. And so unless you think that Jordan Poole leap is actually coming, or the Kuminga leap, or that Moody's going to be a regular part of the rotation, or you're knocking your first-round pick this year out of the park, I think you do need to explore moving him. I just don't know what his value would be around the league. I think if you talk to a bunch of people and they look at the $123 million that he's guaranteed over the next 4 years, that's probably, he's young, and we've seen that he can contribute offensively to a finals team. That's probably going to be viewed as a net negative value contract. And so then you get into talks of, well, yeah, there might be a rebuilding team. Like, couldn't Orlando want to take a chance on him? He's not really a Spursian player, but there are teams where at least the timelines align with his. What do you have to attach to him to get any value? And what does the trade market actually look like this summer? But if I'm the Warriors, to me, that would be the primary focus. I think some people believe it's a little too nuclear, but I can't fathom running it back with this roster and just banking on the internal development of some kids that you didn't even really play much this past year and thinking that's going to give you a different result from this season.
Do you expect Draymond Green to return, though?
I do. I would actually be pretty shocked if he left. Just, I think it's also, you know, forget about what are the Warriors going to pay him. Who else is going to pay him? Like, what team is coming in there with the offer? And so I think that lends itself to probably an easier reunion than a lot of people probably expected, you know, when after he punched Jordan Poole in October, November, whatever it was.
Yeah. All right. It's honestly malpractice on my end that we haven't mentioned the team that's already in the NBA Finals, out of sight, out of mind. The Denver Nuggets, what a squad. What has impressed you most? Like, where have the Nuggets improved most year over year that's allowed them to reach this juncture and perhaps raise the trophy at the end of this thing?
The thing that stands out is just defensively to me. And I think when you look at the top of their personnel, just their first six guys, and knowing that Bruce Brown, Aaron Gordon, KCP are there, you can see a pathway to them being good defensively, but you needed to hold up in the postseason while also playing Jamal Murray and Michael Porter Jr. heavy minutes. And Michael Porter Jr. specifically, I think we saw good defense from Jamal Murray in the conference finals, but Michael Porter Jr. has impressed me a ton from what he did against Phoenix as a rebounder, disrupting with his length, does a lot of the same stuff throughout the playoffs. It's allowed you to field some of your best offensive lineups without committing, you know, any concessions on or as many concessions on the defensive end. And I think you look at Gordon, you look at Michael Porter Jr., and I think Bruce Brown belongs here too. And even Jeff Green at moments, they can play so aggressively with Jokic on defense sometimes. And yet the Nuggets are just able to make their rotations clean up behind him when it's called for. And that's a level that even Nuggets optimists, I don't know if they knew that they could get to and then sustain it, especially if you watch them over the final 4 to 6 weeks of the season, where a lot of people argue, yeah, they're just kind of sleepwalking. They'll turn it on. It's like, I don't know. I was skeptical, but they've done it. And this is absolutely, I mean, they're in the finals, so it goes without saying, but this is kind of a team where it's like, well, should they have just been the finals favorite all along because they were wire to wire, just pretty dominant?
I mean, it's hard to make the argument. I think revisionist history will certainly have us all saying, oh, we saw this coming. We totally saw this coming. I will say there was one guy who saw this. It's not me, nor is it. I met a guy at a barbecue, like, I would say, 4th of July. And he found out what it is I do, and he's just like, you're all sleeping on the Nuggets. And I wrongfully engaged in this conversation. And this dude, made salient point after salient point for like an hour straight, annoyingly. I had nothing. I had no counterpoints. I kept just saying, I don't trust Michael Porter Jr., and I don't trust Aaron Gordon, and I don't trust Nikola Jokic's defense, and he's just like, bam, fact. Here's an anecdote. He was just coming at me left and right, and I think about that dude whose name I don't remember, but his face is etched in my soul. I will think of that dude. I've thought of that dude every day. Every time I look at the standings and I see the Denver Nuggets, I go, that guy called it from a mile away after they had gotten smoked by the Jordan Poole-led Warriors in the first round in five games. He's like, the Nuggets are winning the title next year. So wherever you are, I hope you're listening, that guy. Great conversation, one-sided. You nailed it. You nailed it. And when they win, yes, I have some Nuggets friends, and they'll be celebrating, and I'll get down with them on that. But I gotta find this dude because he's the one dude. He's the one guy who called it from a mile away. I'm with you. I had skepticism all the way out. And if you want to talk about revisionist history, we're gonna look real dumb. We're gonna look real dumb, us in the media, for not giving Nikola Jokic that third MVP. Because now if he raises that trophy, man. Now he is. He probably should be in the Pantheon. With the numbers he's putting up, that dude is insane. It's a beautiful thing for me because he has the same body shape and probably the same vertical leap. it is a spectacular watch to watch that unathletic ogre of a man just wreck the best athletes in the world, just demoralize them on a nightly basis. There's never been anybody like him, but what more can you say about Nikola Jokic?
Yeah, I mean, he's an all-time great, and I think, you know, for people not to have appreciated or understood how valuable he is to this point is kind of mind-blowing, and I almost find myself, and I did pick them to win the title during the preseason. I'm not going to say that I was confident throughout that, but they were my pick.
I love that.
I almost want them to win because one, hashtag agenda, but two, there are going to be people that are like, well, you still can't win with him if he loses in the freaking finals, and I just want that discourse to stop because everything you said was right, though. Even the you know, you're talking about you being skeptical. I was a Nuggets optimist, and I was skeptical. And sometimes maybe it really is, okay, well, this guy's a superstar, and he's about to get his second and third most important player back from injury this year. Maybe this team is just going to be really good, and it's okay to say that and accept it. But I don't think I even trusted it through and through for the entire year.
All right, because we're contractually obligated, we do have to touch on the Los Angeles Lakers. I think LeBron will be back. I think LeBron will show up sometime around Thanksgiving or Christmas when it's all said and done. I think that he just gave us the last bit of great basketball that he has in his body. Never forget, like, this foot injury that he's had this whole time, and it was wildly evident in person, not so much on TV, but in person, it's like, wow, that dude's walking around with cement in his shoes. And he was actually not even wearing his current model shoes in the series against the Warriors. He was back wearing LeBron 2s, which might have well been made out of cement. They were so heavy. They were like army boots. Regardless, he blew that foot out in the effort to get the scoring title. The all-time scoring title. Remember that night where TNT was there and he just decided that Oklahoma City was going to be the team that gave it up, and he went on that one-man show so that everyone could watch it on national TV, which, by the way, the Lakers lost, and he sat out the remainder of the game after getting the record. That's when he blew it out, and it never got right. And I think we saw the last hurrah, even though I do think he'll play two more seasons perhaps. I can't imagine that he's still going to be the same player. And if he's not that dude, this Lakers team gets real mediocre real fast, man. Anthony Davis, I don't think, changed anybody's minds this postseason. You got to like some of the depth. Rui's very good. Austin Reeves plays really hard. D'Angelo Russell and Dennis Schroeder have a time and place. Like, it's not as if they're scrubs. But you have to have the superstar, and without LeBron James, the Lakers do not have a superstar. I'm sorry to say. I mean, Anthony Davis, we can only take so much of the evidence before we make the call. What do you imagine goes down with the Lakers this offseason to address the fact that their best and highest paid player is probably cooked?
Yeah, probably cooked. Really strong phrasing. I'm hoping you're wrong there, but
I'm telling you right now, he is cooked. That foot has turned into deli meat. It is. He's 38 years old. He's never been under anesthesia. Like, we're expecting him to come back from busting the fascia in his foot or a tendon in his foot? Like, I'm sorry, man. He's cooked. He might be able to give you spurts. He might be able to give you nights. He'll take the money. But this thing is going to be a lot closer to the final years of Kobe than it is the final – well, maybe the final years of Jordan is a fair – like, it's not ending well is what I'm saying, Dan. He's cooked, and we can revisit this conversation down the line, but I stand by my statement.
I mean, if that's actually what's going to happen, if he's due for monster regression, you can't really do anything. You already mentioned the issues with Anthony Davis, who he can be super dominant defensively, but his offense is going to be – more of a roller coaster. And he's, at his heart, he's a play finisher. He's not going to create for himself a ton. He's going to create even less for others. And so if you are of the mind that you're the Lakers, that LeBron can't shoulder this workload anymore, which, you know, newsflash, isn't surprising if he doesn't have a foot injury because he's 38 years old, you need to figure out how to get a player who can alleviate some of that half-court offensive burden. And you don't have the assets to do it. And I do think it's telltale that, yes, what they did at the trade deadline, I thought it was really good. But it's also kind of telltale that the best move they made might have been actually just getting rid of Russell Westbrook, because you look at some of the highest stakes moments and Malik Beasley is not on the court. Jared Vanderbilt's not on the court. D'Angelo Russell's not on the court. And so those are your primary acquisitions, and that leaves you in a tough spot. But if you are the Lakers, if you're thinking that LeBron is due for a serious regression, that he can't even, you know, come close to having the season he just had and play in as many games as he just did, get to the 58, 60, 62 game mark, whatever. I would argue there's probably nothing you can do, but you have to figure out a way to get another creator, someone who can run things in there for you, which is just, again, you could technically have cap space if you want, but it won't be enough to just go out and sign Kyrie Irving. So you're going to have to get creative, or more likely just get really lucky on the trade market.
One last question for the great Dan Favalli, Bleacher Report. Is there an NBA draft prospect that you really like? Have you even engaged in the NBA? I mean, we all love Wembanyama, so I guess that we can't use that one. Like, is there somebody that you've, one, watched and two, liked?
Watched would be a strong word, because I do all film work on the draft. I don't know how people keep up with college basketball. I am, however, I'd say like close to knee deep, let's say shin deep in my draft coverage. And so far I'm in love with the guy who stands out, and I don't think it's a surprise, guys, just Anthony Black. Give me that size and that creativity on the ball and what he's going to be able to do as a switchable defender. I think that's someone who comes in and makes an impact right away, but then also ends up being like, oh, how come he wasn't in the conversation for like the fourth overall pick, like right after those top three guys go off the board. And so I think whatever team ends up with him, whether it's, you know, 7, 8, 9 is the range I've seen the most, maybe 10, I think that they're going to wind up hitting a home run with him.
Anthony Black, he had 20 points in Arkansas's loss to UConn in the NCAA tournament, 6'7", 200 pounds, long as all hell. He's got that Anderson Varejao hair happening. I can get behind this. I can get behind this, Dan Favalli. Thanks so much for the insight and the analysis. It is second to none and appreciated as always. And have a great Memorial Day weekend, hopefully filled with at least a couple games of basketball, because, damn it, we need to be entertained.
Yes, you enjoy your Memorial weekend as well, and thanks so much for having me as always, Peter.
The great and ever knowledgeable Dan Favalli. I did not see – I like throwing draft questions at people, because I don't hold it against anybody. I'll tell you straight up, I haven't watched any of this yet. It's one of the things I'm going to do this weekend. That's how I get down on weekends. I'm going to do some grinding of draft tape. Anthony Black is not a name that had come up in the very loose conversations, but every time I get on the phone with somebody around the NBA or adjacent to the NBA, like our friend Dan, like, just love saying, you got a guy? You got a prospect? And everyone's got a different one. It's really enjoyable at this juncture, because sometimes it's just a dude in the second round. And you're thinking, hey, when that guy comes across the ticker during the second round, Mark Tatum's up there, not even announcing it. They're just doing a Taco Bell commercial like they did for Nikola Jokic. You get a little, you go, I know that guy. You're doing the Once Upon a Time in Los Angeles meme. Leo DiCaprio just pointing at the screen. I know that. I know that guy. NBA draft's fun, mainly because it's such a hit or miss situation. Wembanyama's going to do it. I'm certain we'll get off some Wembanyama takes before it's all said and done. Warriors are sitting at 19. Tricky spot. But as Dan let us know, we can talk about down the line, Warriors have to get that one right. Every year they have to get it right. It's the same nonsense narrative, but like, there's more pressure on this year's pick. This feels heavy. This feels heavy. This feels like lottery level heavy for the Golden State Warriors, who, just given the fact that the number two overall pick they selected is no longer with the team, though he did turn into Gary Payton the second, so that was a win. Moses Moody's pretty good. He was technically a lottery pick. Jonathan Kuminga's a good player, but is he a Warrior moving forward? I don't know. So is that a win of a pick or not? It's kind of hard to say. Guy played 20 minutes a game as a 20-year-old. I'd like to think it's a win, but he couldn't play in the playoffs. So is that a loss? I saw Moses Moody out there. 19th pick has some serious weight to it because of the way that the collective bargaining agreement is structured. They might as well have just called it the anti-Warriors collective bargaining agreement, because you're getting rid of the mid-level exception for the highest-paying teams, which the Warriors will be in perpetuity so long as Steph Curry is making $50, $60 million a year. Klay Thompson's on the rise. I mean, two guys, $100 million right there. That's before you get to Draymond Green with Klay Thompson and Steph Curry. You don't get the mid-level exception, which the Warriors haven't always used, but like, it was Dante DiVincenzo this year. You needed Dante DiVincenzo this year. And then you can only sign guys who are on the minimum. You can sign G League dudes. You can sign rookies. And if the Warriors do what they want to do, this is the last sort of high pick that they have for a long time. We'll find out if that's the case or not. They never thought they'd be picking number two overall. They got to get this one right. Looks like a good draft class to get it right. A lot of depth. Obviously a very high-end, top-caliber 1-2-3. Scoot Henderson, Victor Wembanyama, and Brandon Miller, who is... I'm willing to take an outside bet he's the best player in this draft. Wembanyama is like sick and really cool to look at, but is he strong? I mean, he's got some Kristaps Porzingis to him. Hell of a good player, but... is he really a game changer? Have you thought about Kristaps Porzingis very much? Meanwhile, Brandon Miller's like 6'9", 6'10", can get buckets over anybody, and is a really good defender with serious range. We're talking like a Jason Tatum type. Maybe a little less. Maybe pull it back. Maybe a Kawhi Leonard type. Maybe I went too far there again. Maybe we pull it back. I'm just saying. It's a league that's defined by wings, or the greatest passing big man of all time, in the case of Nikola Jokic. And he's a pretty damn good wing prospect. Warriors aren't going to get him, but this is a draft class, from what I can tell from the conversations I've had, that has some serious depth, and the Warriors got to get it right. Doesn't sound like they're going to get Anthony Black, though, according to our good friend Dan Favalli. Maybe we throw some names around next time I'm on. It'll be a little bit closer. We'll have our appetites a bit more whetted for the NBA draft, because, well, right now we're still on the come down from whatever the hell that was that ended the Warriors season. All right, I'll tell you what we're going to do next. Best of KMBR today on KMBR tonight. It's one of my favorite segments. Should be one of yours too. If you missed any of our good stuff today, you don't have to go to our podcast page on KMBR.com. You can just hang out with me for the next little bit. Best of KMBR today on KMBR tonight. Kurtenbach until 11 on The Sports Leader.
Golfers, get ready to elevate your Saturday mornings. Yeah, it's Brian Murphy here, and I am thrilled to introduce the Clubhouse Corner with Ben and Eddie. This is a passion project from the good folks at the Clubhouse in Fremont. These two are on a mission to make golf accessible and enjoyable for the masses. So set your alarm. 7 a.m. every Saturday, join Ben and Eddie at the Clubhouse Corner, only on KNBR.